Hi there, this is Wafala Bedat. You're listening to the Woman Power Podcast, a subsidiary platform to the Woman Power Summit, the largest event in MENA, with the aim of empowering women and helping them achieve their absolute highest potential. Each week on the Woman Power Podcast, you will hear honest, vulnerable, authentic, real conversations from inspiring women. These women will share their experiences and stories into what it takes to build a successful business and career. The podcast will share insight and inspiration and hopefully inspire action and lead change. Thank you to our friends at Zenon Cycling for sponsoring this episode of the Women Power Podcast. Shima Nafisi is a leading budding entrepreneur in our region and is the founder of Elysian Water and the CEO of Scan for Water. Previously, she's been working in Aramco, having left her job to pursue her dream of starting a business for sustainable water. Shima's time living in Norway became an important milestone when developing her business. Her journey with Elysian is backed by years of research, as well as an entire process of sourcing clean water, enough to be able to provide quality, bottled drinking water to the world. Welcome, Shima. Shima, I'm so excited to have you with me today. I just wanted to ask you, how have you been during COVID? How have you been during this really strange time in our life?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here with you. And listen, I like to look at the glass half full. I'm trying to look at things positively. And personally, I'm doing well. It took time to find that happy medium, you know, but I did, thankfully. It takes a lot of emotional work and self-talk to adapt to this new normal. You know, I'm spending time with my parents and trying not to gain the COVID-20. You know how they had that COVID, or excuse me, the freshman 15 in college. I've upped it up to the 20. So trying not to do that. But, you know, again, just practicing self-love and self-acceptance. I've been socially distancing since I don't want to take a risk with my parents being a bit elderly. And listen, it's scary times nonetheless, but we have to make the best of it. By nature, we as humans are adaptable. So that's how I look at it. You have to adapt to the situation. And I think also, honestly, getting into a routine really helps.
So you started a business a couple of years ago. Has it been affected by COVID? It seems to me sometimes there are people who are about to start a business, so COVID let them kind of put things on hold for them to reassess or wait a little bit longer. But has it affected your work in any way? Or do you feel, you know, it's fine and it was time for me to reflect and work and kind of think and strategize?
I mean, I think, honestly, it's both. I mean, there is the negative side of it because obviously COVID has affected everybody, every business. The FMCG sector, which I'm in for, you know, which stands for the fast moving consumer goods. Water is, you know, people need water. But I also was a new brand that was entering into the market. So it did make a little difficult where people started buying less. You know, people are kind of holding their riyals and dinars more than they were before. But again, I've adapted that. And where I saw there was not an opportunity for me to make sales, I took it elsewhere. One of the biggest challenges, I think, is not being able to be in Bahrain, because as you know, my headquarters is in Bahrain and my office and my team are all physically in Bahrain. And it makes it that much harder when you're trying to lead your team being away from them. Accountability is different, KPIs are different, you know. So I think it's been a little challenging to work remotely and not being present with my team. It almost has doubled the work, which is okay with me because I love what I do. But nonetheless, it's, you know, you've got to, the follow-up is a lot more, you know, the micromanaging, I should say, has increased, which I try to stray away from. But that has become a reality in this situation.
Do you feel you are a recovering micromanager, or are you still, no, I'm at the early stages of my business and I need to be on top of things?
Well, listen, I get a lot of my sound business advice from my father, and the people that are around me have built, you know, kind of empire in the corporate world or in the diplomatic world. And so I respect that. And he's always told me, don't micromanage. But owning a business from the baby stages, from infancy stages, you have to. And at the beginning, I was like, well, I'm not going to do that. And I noticed that, you know, a lot of things were were not getting done, or things were, you know, kind of left aside, because no one really cares about your business more than you. And that is the reality. You know, you will have people that are loyal to you and loyal to the brand. And I have found some that are of that mentality. But the reality is, I have to be within every step, unfortunately, at this stage.
I met both your parents. It's so interesting. So you have a Saudi father and an American mother, you know, was able to get to know them, that they have such strong characters. Can you tell me more about growing up in that kind of household, and what have you learned from your parents?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, my father is Riyadh native and my mother is a Tucson, Arizona native, and they met at the University of Arizona in 1969. You know, my father graduated as a chemical engineer and my mother was a double major in languages. So she wanted to work at the UN as an interpreter. And they, you know, love took hold and they married and they moved to Riyadh. And my father started 1 year career at Saudi Aramco in 1977. And we kind of, my mother was actually an English teacher there in Ras Tanura, which is a compound belonging to Aramco. And my brother came along in 1978 and she decided to stay home and raise her family. And yeah, I get a little bit of everything from my parents. My father is, again, the diplomatic sort of sound business advice, even though he was never an entrepreneur. So he gives me a lot of wisdom, but I kind of have to curtail that into, you know, my own wisdom with the other life of being a business owner, because it's totally different than owning or being working in a corporate job. And my mother, I get my strength, honestly. That's, you know, my resilience. She's a strong cookie. So, you know, that I get a little bit of good from both. But yeah, growing up, going back to how we got here, I was born in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia. And my siblings and I attended Dhahran Ahliya School. And in the summer of 1991, we went to visit my father, 1991. And you know, that year was the year the Gulf War broke out. And we ended up staying in New York because my father didn't want us, it wasn't safe enough for us to go back to Saudi. So I ended up staying in New York and we went private school in New York City. And so we lived in New York for 2 years and then came back to Saudi and sort of tried to find, you know, ground that was comfortable for us because we had lost Arabic and we went back to the same school. And my mother was more comfortable with us going to a school in Bahrain, and that was Ibn Khaldun. And that's where I finished out my years of high school at Ibn Khaldun.
What did you study in the state? You know, what was your first job?
I went to Kent State University thinking that, so that was in Ohio. It is in Ohio, rather. And I went to study because I wasn't like of a study mind. I wasn't a nerd. I liked accomplishing things, but I didn't like studying and reading books, not books of my choice, you know, books that I had to read. So I went to Kent State thinking that I want to do fashion, like I wanted to be a fashion buyer. And that really just quickly, I knew that it wasn't for me. So I moved to the sister school, which is University of Akron. And that's where I graduated from. And I graduated with a degree in PR and organizational communication. And I my college years were awesome. I loved, you know, living my college years out and not being, you know, it's like those rebellious years that you have to live out. And it was great. And then I graduated and came back to Saudi. And that's when I started my career at Aramco.
Was that your first job and you stayed on for quite some time?
Actually, my first job was in high school when I was finishing high school in Michigan, and I was a cashier at a Walgreens. And then I was like, okay, I'm a little too, you know, ego at that time. You know, you want to be, it's hard to humble yourself at 17, 18. And so I said, I want to do something more challenging, you know? So I talked to the managers at the Walgreens if I could, you know, be a pharmacy technician. So I was a pharmacy technician throughout my co-op in high school. I would have rather worked, you know, because they give you the choice to do a co-op, a job co-op, or take a class. And I was like, no, I'll do the job co-op because I'd much rather work. So I did the pharmacy tech for about a year, and I liked it. I mean, I was good at it.
What did working at Walgreens and, you know, in the pharmacy, what did it teach you? Like, what's the one thing you walked away from that experience with?
Listen, I love accomplishing. I love knowing that there was obviously the downside of every job, and there's negative and, you know, strife and everything. I saw things, you know, working at a pharmacy, obviously, that were a little bit sad, where people were, you know, ill, or they had addiction issues or whatever. But for me, it was about learning how to deal with people from all walks of life. And again, you know, having responsibility. I've always pretty much been responsible, even when I was irresponsible, air quotes. But it taught me that, you know, listen, if you're committing to something, then you've got to commit the whole way through. And I think that was my biggest takeaway with that.
So you moved to Aramco. Did you apply for a job? Did someone help you find a job?
I actually did apply. I waited. I didn't get hired right away. I had to go through the whole hiring process, even though, you know, they knew my last name, and there is a mentality, and, you know, more or less now, because that was back in 2007, there is more of a mentality of nepotism and cronyism. And that doesn't always necessarily mean that it's a bad thing. It's just a part of our culture. But I actually had to wait about a year and something to get the job, you know, job offer. And I didn't. I had to go through the interview process. And it was, I remember it was three Americans that were interviewing me. And I ended up working with two of them. Two of them were my colleagues, and one of them ended up being my supervisor. So, you know, I was appreciative of that process. I didn't want to just have someone say, hey, you got this because you know somebody, or you got this because of, you know, whatever, as we say, nepotism. I started the job in end of 2007. And I loved it. I mean, it was a short-winded time frame, but I learned a lot about myself, especially working for Aramco.
I've never been to Aramco, and I think for people who are not based in Saudi, it's hard to comprehend the magnitude of Aramco. So what was it like working there, and what did you do?
Well, I mean, the magnitude, obviously, it's one of the biggest oil companies, petroleum companies in the world. What I did was not of the engineering side. So obviously, because with my PR degree, I was put into a department that still wasn't really built up as much as it should have been. And why I say that is because PR is a Western practice. And, you know, today they're very much different in their mentality and their thinking and their business practices in PR than they were when I started. When I started, it was very limited, and the only spokesperson was the oil minister at the time, His Excellency Ali Naimi. So, you know, it was hard for us to deal with the media. What I did was I was the liaison between the media, international media, I should say, not the domestic, the international media, and the company. And I kind of got, you know, thrown in that situation because I pretty much proved to the management at the time that I was capable, and I wanted to work, and I wanted to accomplish things. And I am about, you know, setting a standard and making change. I wasn't going to settle for the status quo. So I guess they saw that. But I, you know, I came in, and you have all these people that have been in the department for years and years, and I'm coming in here, this newbie, this young person, and, you know, with all this fire. And sometimes that's not accepted or invited as you would think. So it was a little bit challenging, but I you know, nonetheless, I had, and I worked around an amazing team of, it was four Americans and one Canadian, and my supervisor was an American, and I learned so much from them. They were all, you know, historian backgrounds and, you know, oil and energy sector, and they've been, you know, just leaders in their fields, and I was really, really lucky to have been placed in that company.
You know, if you come in with a lot of fire, you know, you want to create change, you're basically supporting to build this whole new department. You said it wasn't always welcome. Can you tell me why you felt that way?
Well, listen, I actually was not from, my superiors were really very, they wanted to, they saw the drive, they saw the motivation of wanting to create change, and they were supportive of that. So I was lucky. But it was sort of the colleagues around me that have been there for 10 years, 15 years, you know, 5 years even. And here I'm coming in, like I said, this newbie wanting to see change. And, you know, let's be realistic. There is jealousy amongst, you know, your certain colleagues or people. It's a very natural emotion. So I saw that. Can't say that I really, you know, accepted it. And I perhaps even now I'm a lot different because I'm older. I would have dealt with it differently in certain situations. But, you know, it didn't really affect me directly because they weren't my superiors. My superiors were pretty supportive. So I was lucky about that. If I came and I suggested something or that we, you know, do something, you know, a certain interview, because I was, again, the liaison, one of the liaisons for the international, and ended up being the liaison for the international media department at the company, which is amazing, you know, just by default, because no one else was there. The guy that had been there for many years went to work for another company, and I came into that position. But yeah, I think there's certain things that I look back on and say I could have dealt with that differently, and that's fine. It's just about growing and dealing with situations in a more mature way.
So throughout this interview, you've mentioned a couple of times that you love to achieve things. You felt that in school, you felt that in university. You said, you know, I'm quite driven. Where does that drive come from?
That's a really good question. And I think that in and of itself comes from, what is my purpose? You know, everyone is kind of looking for their purpose in life. And I wanted to know, you know, we go out, we go through our lives, you know, not sure where our next step is going to be, you know. That's how I felt in many instances in my life, growing up in a bicultural marriage that didn't help because, you know, I'm here, my mother is a Westerner, but learned how to speak Arabic fluently and, you know, molded into the culture and just beautifully. And still, you as a product of that environment, it causes confusion. So, you know, and every teenager and person and child and adolescent and adult goes through that. But I think the biggest thing is, what God is my purpose? You know, what am I supposed to be doing in this life? And I think that's always the question in my mind. It wasn't as clear when I was younger, but now that's still the question that I ask myself, or ask God. You know, God, what is my purpose? Show me what I need to be doing. If I'm going to do something, I want to make an imprint somehow, even a small imprint. I think I've always, that innately has always been in me. It's just the message is a lot more clear now.
So what is your purpose, Shima? Are you still searching?
I'm still looking. But, you know, I think this is one of them, you know, being and creating Elysian is one of them for sure, without a doubt, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, I think, you know, even the times that I'm like, oh my God, I'm crazy. What am I doing? This is just not right. I don't know what I'm thinking. Then I, you know, kind of get this voice, you know, and in my head, and I realize that, okay, wait a second. This is bigger than you. This is bigger than what you even intend it to be. It has to be. And that is just a feeling I have in my gut. I trust that feeling. So I, you know, even though I have found partial of my, you know, a bit of my purpose, I still know that there's more to come. And I just have to follow that and trust that.
Do you miss the corporate life, or are you over it? And do you feel like, no, this is where I'm meant to be right now?
I miss the fact that it was, you know, you have a check coming in every month. And that is definitely something that I think about. But I would never go back, and I would never change where I am right now. And this is where I'm meant to be indefinitely.
So for anybody who's listening, who's thinking of like making the leap out of corporate and starting a business, what are the biggest things that you felt were challenges?
One of the hardest decisions in my life. You know, I wasn't happy. And a lot of times people stay, you know, I know people listening to this. Please remember that if you're not happy in something, don't continue to do it. You know, make that change. It's scary. It's really scary. That leap is frightening. But it will pay off in the end. If it's meant to be, then it will be. As cliche as that sounds, you know. I think again, you know, going back to it was the hardest decision in my life. There are certain things that led up to that. And I was working at an affiliate office for Aramco because I wanted to expand my knowledge in PR and then go back and teach the department. We wanted, you know, have set out guidelines and set out a system, and that was agreed. Unfortunately, that work with the affiliate office was a phone call that my father made to, you know, someone he knew and said, you know, get her into that office quickly. It would have happened anyway. It was just the process would have been a lot slower. And plus, my father was living in New York. My parents were living in New York at that time because my father had started his diplomacy at the UN after retiring from Aramco. So I didn't want to be in Saudi by myself. I'm very attached to my parents. So it just made sense that I was in the States with them. So that process sort of went faster with that phone call that my dad made. And I always say, you shouldn't have made it, you shouldn't have done that. But I think back and I'm like, no, it happened for a reason. I had to go through that whole strife in working for that affiliate office for a reason. It was poor leadership. My presence was just not appreciated. You know, I'm a strong energy. And sometimes people don't know how to react to that. And I'm when you know me, you know that I'm a kitty cat. I mean, you know me. And, you know, it's about sort of people misjudging and people having insecurities, as I do. But I try to look beyond that because it's work. It's been emotional work that I try to do, you know, look beyond whatever you see on the surface. But going back to the point, I had to go through those mishaps in order to realize, hey, this is where that's what needed to happen sequentially so I can get to the point where I could say, okay, I'm not going to do this, but I am going to do something that is meaningful. And it took me a long time. I mean, for a year, it was horrible in the sense where I didn't know what I was going to do. I was doing a lot of like personal and life changes and, you know, trying to better myself. As I do every day, you have to. But work was like, what am I going to do next? And I think that was the biggest, those were the times that I was really challenged without having work. Because I love being busy and I love accomplishing, as I've been saying. It's just a part of my personality, you know?
Do you remember the exact moment where you felt like, okay, now I'm ready to hand in my resignation and move on to my next chapter? Can you tell us more about that specific moment?
Yeah, I think it wasn't a moment. Well, I take that back. It kind of led up to, you know, when I was at the affiliate office, I hadn't made that decision. So I was supposed to go back to Lahran, just a bit of a rewind. I was supposed to go back to Lahran to train and work with the PR department. And that was that after I left the affiliate office and I went back to Michigan where we have our family home, I was asked to come back and I felt I wasn't ready. So they kind of gave me, you know, a time period. Either you come back at this time or, you know, you can make the decision not to come back at all. And I'm like, you know what? That's God speaking to me. And this is what's meant to happen. It was tough. And my awesome supervisor, poor guy, he had to be, you know, never shoot the messenger, but he had to be the one to send me that email. But I was really glad, number one, it came from him. And I was really glad that was God saying, this is your destiny. This is the start. So I'm going to help you make that decision. And that's what happened.
You said earlier that you know that your energy is overpowering and different people deal with that differently. Why do you feel like your energy is so overpowering? Is that feedback you've received from people? Is that something you noticed about yourself?
Yeah, I don't say it negatively. I say it that I have a strong presence. I have a strong, you know, and I've had to, it took me time. I mean, I'll be 40 in a couple of months. So it's been a gradual a slow recognition on my behalf. You know, you walk into a room and kind of, you know, all eyes on you. That's energy. I could be trying to walk in like a mouse and, you know, it doesn't work. You know, and I've had to accept that I have that type of, for lack of better words, presence. That's God-given. And I could do something with that. I still have yet to hone it. And I still have yet to work it. And strength comes in humility. Strength comes in putting your ego to a side. Strength comes in, you know, vulnerability. And that, we all as a society have to work on that. And we're raised, I was raised, honestly, in a very loving family, but also a family that you can't really, you know, ultimately express yourself. You know, if your anger is a healthy emotion, it's how you express it. It's the communicative act of saying, you know, listen, I'm not okay with this, or I have a boundary. And those are things I'm having to teach myself at almost 40. And, you know, I'm appreciative of it. I'm appreciative that I know these things, because some people go out throughout life not knowing any of this. And that's a lot of self-awareness. So I really think that being self-aware is ultimately, I mean, that's everything, because that's how you change yourself.
Has anyone ever told you if that matches what you're doing, or is there a mismatch, or is that something that you've never come across?
Alhamdulillah, I've never come across that. And if someone was to say that, I'd ask them why, you know, why they think that. Because I'd be curious to truly, you know, understand why, where the thought process is. You know, I rely on my faith, and I rely on my connection to God and my spirituality to kind of take me through this journey. And I know that, you know, that sounds, you know, to some people like, okay, whatever, you know, but that really is how a lot of how I got here. And I do definitely always have to remind myself, Shiva, you got to be good, because, you know, if you're not, then you're not gonna, you know, you reap what you sow, basically. And, you know, I've got to be patient with people. I've got to, you know, treat people with, you know, all from all walks of, whether they're not positive energies, whether they're, you know, a negative force, I have to treat it with love, and I have to treat it with, you know, patience. And so I haven't come across anyone telling me that I have a mismatch of energy, but I would be curious to hear why.
Talk to me about your spiritual connection with God. I mean, do you do the usual? Do you pray? Do you meditate? Do you just talk to God in your head? Like, what do you do to kind of foster that relationship?
All the above, honestly. And yeah, I mean, I think that from whatever background you come from whatever religion you come from, whatever belief it is, you have to believe in something higher and bigger than yourself and bigger than us, because in essence, we are just these tiny, minute little organisms, you know, walking through life that have, you know, all kinds of issues. And you know, we have the positive parts, but we're human, we're fallible. So I think, yeah, it's definitely a personal thing. I don't, you know, go around being raised in Saudi and going to school in Saudi and learning all these, having all these religion classes. I mean, we literally had 5-6 religion classes out of like 9 classes out of the day, you know, in Saudi. And that's great. But I think religion is, it's a personal thing. It's between you and God or, you know, that higher power. And so, you know, I definitely do pray, and you know, again, it's that personal connection between me and that higher power. And you have to, it's about, again, humbling yourself and, you know, and being submissive to that. And yeah, it is a very powerful force in my life. It's the driver in my life. But again, I keep it very personal. And that's why you've known me so long. And, you know, you and I haven't had that conversation. But I always say that, you know, Bainaka Wabain Rabbak, you know, and that to me, it's an intimate, special relationship. And that's how it should be.
For the third year in a row, we are excited to host a completely new experience of the Women Power Summit. Our new event, the Women Digital Festival, is happening on November 15th and 16th. It'll be our first ever digital conference with over 10,000 women and more than 100 speakers in attendance. Our event will be jam-packed full of digital conversations, panels, workshops, and mentor sessions. This stay-at-home digital summit is fantastic for small biz owners, entrepreneurs, creators, and young professionals. It'll be all about building, growing, and pivoting in the new normal. Some of the topics we cover will be about money, wellness, working from home, and feature fantastic stories by leading women. Tickets are only $53 and will give you access to our online networking platform where you can exchange business cards with fellow delegates and have access to a digital gift bag full of goodies and to our virtual expo. Sign up in the link in the bio of our Instagram account. Don't miss out. See you there. For the third year in a row, we are excited to host a completely new experience of the Women Power Summit. Our new event, the Women Digital Festival, is happening on November 15th and 16th. It'll be our full of goodies and to our virtual expo. Sign up in the link in the bio of our Instagram account. Don't miss out. See you there. I wanted to ask you as well about, so you made the leap into becoming an entrepreneur. It's not easy. So you said you were pathfinding for a couple of years as well, trying to figure out your next move or what, you know, what you wanted to do next or what idea you should kind of latch onto or adopt. And can you tell me more about the idea of Elysian and where that came from?
Yeah, that moment where I'm like, I want to be an entrepreneur, that never happened. So, you know, it really was just about, again, trusting that process, trusting in you know, God, that God is going to put me on the right path. And when I lived in Norway for about, you know, on and off, but then I left the States to go back to Norway because my father was there doing his work. And I basically, it was a conversation between my father and I, because every day, you know, we'd sit down for dinner after he came back. And, you know, I said, Baba, you know, what do you think? What do you think of this? And what do you think of ideas? We just kind of talked about ideas. And then this idea of having, you know, investing in water was just kind of, it was very blasé. It wasn't even, he's like, well, you know, do you think that you would want to, you know, venture into that? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Water is life. And so that was kind of the moment where, you know, the aha moment that water made sense, you know. And it wasn't like, okay, I'm going to be a business owner, I'm going to start this company. And I didn't know where I was going to go with it. But I knew that I wanted to work within water, you know. I know that sounds funny, but, and I had no idea that there was, you know, investment opportunities or a shortage of water, because that really, come to find out, there is investment opportunities. And yes, water is a commodity, and, you know, just like oil and gold are, and there is a shortage, and that shortage is very scary, of, you know, fresh water and clean drinking water. And I think, from what I've seen, the findings that I have found was that water is not all sourced equally. And that was, you know, that was not an one aha moment. That was a process that I came about. So eventually, after that conversation in Norway, I moved back to Saudi and I established Scan for Water 2015. It was an idea before that. And then finally 2015, we made it a company, we established it as a company. And then, you know, after Scan was established, Elysian came along. Scan, let me rewind a little. Scan was established because I wanted to create a company where I was, for lack of better words, you know, scanning, searching the world for good quality natural resources. And that was, you know, obviously it's now diversified. The thought and the action has diversified into food sources, but it started out as water, because again, bottled water, you and I have had this conversation many times, bottled water regulations are not as stringent as tap water. And in this part of the world and in the GCC, we can't drink the tap water. So we are forced to drink, you know, bottled water, for lack of better words, forced. We have to drink. It's more safe to drink bottled water. But then again, not all bottled water is made equally. So it wasn't one aha moment that I knew that I wanted. It sort of transcended into that. And it was a process. I always say you have to trust the process that you're going through, because that's how you're going to get to where you've, most likely have envisioned or where you're meant to be.
What were you most shocked about in this transition from working in an organization to working solo?
Well, I mean, you know, honestly, I mean, there's every day you find out more and more that, you know, this is, as you said, everything falls on your head. I always say Aramco was this well-oiled machine, and I was a little part of that machine. And now, working on my own, I had to, building this and still building it, I have to build my own machine, and with no blueprint, with no instruction manual. You're the engineer, the foreman, the secretary, the marketer, everything. So, you know, it's a huge difference. You're going from one world to another, and, you know, the challenges, they vary every day. You know, I mean, obviously, funding is one challenge. Personnel and recruitment is another challenge. I mean, that's a daily thing for me. You know, you want to, having this much passion and this much love for what I want to do and my purpose, it's hard to find people to match that. Because people are usually, let's be realistic here, they're motivated by money. And you have to, you know that as a leader, you have to motivate them beyond that. And that tends to be, I think, one of the most challenging things for me.
I think as a business owner, my biggest issue was, wow, hiring more people is more work for me. And then, like you said, like for the longest time, I used to work with different people and I would be so shocked that nobody would be working as much as me. Like, what do you mean you're not working as much as me, like the same amount of hours? And it took me such a long time. And I think, I don't know if it's like being naive, but I would think, okay, well, you should know that the more we both work and the more we work smartly, it's going to come back to you. I can promote you. But it's just, we have a culture of reward me now and I'll work for you versus I'll earn the reward, if that makes any sense. Yeah, so I think it is definitely tough. I think managing people is still, and I always tell my mother this, if I would have issues at work, what do I do? Because she's in HR and she's, why do you think there are so many books on management and managing people and courses? And it's a billion-dollar industry because this is the hardest part of your job. So that really made me feel better. Like, oh, so I'm not the only one suffering. Like, we're all suffering together.
Absolutely, yeah. And that did help. That really helped that I was amongst other people that were that were suffering in the same, you know, same token for the same reason. And I always say, I always remind myself, people don't want to be managed, they want to be led, you know? And how do I create them to want to be led? And how do I create these followers, basically, for lack of better statements? And that, I think, I'm still trying to learn, because that comes with a lot of patience, and that's something I still am working on till this day. You know, we all have our mishaps, and that's one of mine, is that I take things really personally, because when it is your business and your money and your time and your money, you know, they don't get that. And you know, a lot of these people are really smart and they're college graduates or they've worked before. I don't really hire, you know, I was hiring sort of fresh graduates and I stopped doing that, because for this, I need a core team that really is strong and that will make me strong, because I always say, without you guys, I can't be. And I try. You know, the reality is some people will be led and can be led, and some people just can't. But I also have to accept that I made a lot of mistakes by choosing wrong people and leaving them in the organization because of fear that I was not going to find someone else. And then I would get to a point where I would just want to pull every single hair out of my head. And you know, I have a lot of hair. I think that was my biggest takeaway, is that as soon as someone shows you they don't want to be led, hit the road, Jack, and don't come back, you know? And, you know, wish them luck and be really, you know, give hugs, e-hugs and whatever, but don't keep them around, because, and that has been very valuable to me. But then again, because I have such a small team right now and I'm still building that team, again, you know, we're only in year two operationally, but I think I have to, you know, I always question, is it me? Am I just, because I do believe in energy and attracting maybe the wrong energy sometimes, you know, maybe there's one facet of my life, my personal life, that I have to work on better, say my patience, or, you know, giving, being more vulnerable with people and not showing them, you know, the side that takes away from that vulnerability, if that makes sense.
No, I think it totally makes sense. I mean, part of my experience or my journey with managing people, when I started out, I thought they were all my friends. And, you know, I would buy them gifts. And, you know, I'm their boss and I will always be their manager first. And I really thought that just because, you know, my name was on the door, was that, you know, we were all friends, not even colleagues. And then, you know, as like my first wave of resignations happened, which happens in agency life, like 1 in 4 people leave an agency within a year. It's not for everybody. I was really upset. I took it so personally, like, because I thought they were leaving me. Then I became really cold. So then I feel like I reversed it, where I embraced my supervisor hat. I became a lot more tougher, a lot more colder. And, you know, I had this mentality of, you know, everybody's replaceable, and to a certain extent, like, and not in a mean way, but, you know, everyone can be not replaceable, like in a mean way, but that's everybody true. Can leave, yes. and go on to do their thing. And then you could, you know, replace them with somebody else who hopefully can take your business to the next level. And now, right. I feel, you know, 12 years later, I'm definitely in like a nice area where I feel I'm friends with some of my team members, but I also understand that this is a job, and if they wish to leave, it's fine. So I need to also like not be attached. That was such a painful, like, I went to therapy to be like, they're all gonna leave me. And then she was, you're the one making them leave you, like, you need to not be afraid. And it took me such a long time to like even start to think in that way, that it's okay that if everyone leaves, I'm able to still, you know, I'm the driving force and I can build the team again. So yeah, it is really such a crazy ride dealing with people, and managing a team. You said that there's a shortage of water, which is really hard to comprehend when 70% of our earth is made up of water. But, you know, in a nutshell, can you tell me, what does that mean?
Well, our earth's crust is 70% water. But the reality is, we're talking about fresh water. We're not talking about water you can't drink, right? So fresh water is diminishing, and it's because of normal things that the earth cycle is going through. Climate change is one. Mismanagement sometimes of, you know, of certain countries of their water resources, that's another. And also, our population is growing, and, you know, the use of water is, when the population grows, the use of water also increases. So you have all these different factors, if you will. And, you know, I think obviously not every country has the same type of sources. I look to the Scandinavian countries. Now I'm, you know, I'm looking to the Scandinavian, and starting with Norway, because they just God-given, you know, they're fresh water. They've got a lot of underground springs, and their terrain is really vast. And you and I have always had this conversation that the source is clean when it's not inhabited by a population. So if it's a smaller population or not inhabited at all, like in many areas of Iceland, that have, like, you know, 800-year-old glaciers. That's different. It's a different type of fresh water. But you know, those countries, they're water-rich countries. And the reality is that the dependency on these water-rich countries is going to increase. I mean, Alaska, Canada, that's, you know, on that side of the world, that's, you'll find a lot of good sort of fresh, clean water in those countries. But the reality is, yes, water has been dubbed blue gold because it will eventually be as valuable as petroleum or gold. You know, again, looking at the science, and we try to rely on a lot of the science, and a lot of things, you know, differ, a lot of different, you know, reports come out. But I think, you know, it already is kind of happening now. And by 2025, there's going to be, you know, an alarming diminishing rate of fresh water that's going to happen, according to the UN. Well, listen, there's not one solution, but I think, you know, we have to manage our water resources better. I think, you know, there is a fine line between looking at water as a commodity and looking at it as a natural resource. The making water a commodity is, you know, it's looked at, it's looked at differently. You know, some look at it as an opportunity, and some look at it as, you know, as a negative thing, where it's not creating a free market for our natural resources, if that makes sense. Again, that I think one of the solutions is what we're doing now, is to, because the water has obviously no value until it's caught, captured, and, you know, bottled, really. But the reality also is that in many parts of the world, you can't drink the tap water. The tap water is just, you know, it's got it's polluted, or the turbine, or the pipeline, I should say, that it flows through will pollute that in and of itself. But I think, you know, it's not, again, it's not one thing that countries can do. Also, awareness is huge as well. And, you know, when you look at these higher GDP countries with regulations like Norway and Iceland and Finland, you know, they have things put in place. Regulations put in place. So, you know, obviously the landowner will own the source, and the source be commoditized. And that, I think, you know, again, it's a fine line, but, you know, that is a way of managing a natural resource.
One of the things that I learned about you was we all have a water palate. I still use that story when I talk to people, and I never understood why I liked certain brands versus other brands. Can you tell me more about our water palate and why we prefer salty water versus sweeter water?
Yeah, so you said it, it's one's palate, and some people can't really tell the difference. But a lot of people can, and I know you and I can. That's why we've had these conversations. There is a difference between hard and soft water, and what signifies that is, or dictates, I should say, that is the total dissolved solid, which is all the minerals, the anions and cations, which are the positive and negative charged atoms that are in the water, the elements, I should say. Magnesium, sodium, calcium, that will change the taste of the water. A higher TDS will give you, you know, it could give you a whole plethora of things. The lower the TDS, the less that you're going to feel that there is like a harshness to the water. So I, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I do try and read up a lot on these, you know, water quality and what makes water different. And you know, honestly, it's been hard to find a hydrologist. I had gotten a hold of, you know, a water quality expert some time back, but they're afraid of talking to a privatized company, so I've noticed. And that's a shame, because we really need to be putting honesty. We need to be honest about, yes, commoditizing water is a good thing. It's a healthy thing. But you should be selling water that's not full of bromide or arsenic. The FDA does govern certain levels of these elements in the water. I think personally some of them are too high, but you know, that's what the law says, that you can allow that. Because a lot of these things, like arsenic, it's a carcinogen, it's cancer causing. Eventually it can be. So, you know, I think, you know, and you're ingesting water, you know, it's the most ingested thing, you know, throughout your day, or you should be, at least, you know, 2.7 for us and 3.7 for men, and, you know, liters, I should say. And, you know, you've got to have, it's not about, I always tell people, I'm not pushing you to drink our water because it's a marketing thing. I know what's in it. You know, I know what's in Elysian and I know what's in this water that I'm selling. I actually had tested, you know, here's a story. I tested Norwegian water before I partnered with my current supplier. I tested two different waters. One was, the first one I tested was not completely kosher and clean. And the second one was, but business and transparency was not there. So you obviously can't have a transparent relationship when, you know, if you don't have a transparent relationship, I should say, with the person you're partnering with, then it's not gonna have a good start or a good end to it. So it was meant to be that I ended up with that, you know, my current supplier. But yeah, there are a lot of different qualities to water that people should be aware of.
What's the one thing we should be looking at when we look at labels of water brands? I know it's a lot and these labels are just like designed to just put you off. It's all these code words that nobody understands. But if there is one thing we had to look at just to kind of make a decision about what water to put in our body every day, what would it be?
Well, I think low sodium, you know, low sodium should be, because you're getting, obviously, you're getting sodium intake from, you know, everything else that maybe your food, you know, well, it is your food and other things you ingest. That, and I think TDS are two main things. And then also, honestly, the source. If it's a natural source, then you're better off with a natural source than you are with something that's chemically altered or ionized or, you know, purified. You know, you want to stay away from those. You want to go for like the natural sourced water. Or natural resource.
Your industry is so competitive. I mean, you have so many water brands, the margins are so low. And then on top of that, you are stocking in supermarkets. You know, I call them the supermarket mafia, because stocking in supermarkets is one of the most challenging things I think you're going to have to experience and go through. It's just, you know, if you want a bit of branding, you have to pay for it. You have to pay for the shelf space. You have to pay percentage. It's just a nightmare. If you could go back knowing all that you know about water, the margins in water, would you still do it again? Or do you feel, you know, it's too late now and I'm already in it to win it, so I might as well just power through?
No, I mean, I never want for one second think that. And I also know that I have a beautiful product. And I mean, you and I have always talked about this, that our product is, it really is truly what we say it is. And why I chose the name Elysian is because it signified bliss and, you know, a sublime state, you know, out of this world. Because there is water in this world that is, you know, clean and still, you know, void of microbes and void of, you know, any dangerous elements. You know, arsenic is an earth element. It's going to be there. It's going to be there, but should be there in very, very small percent, like 0.01 parts per billion, you know? And so going, you know, answering your question, no, I would never, I never feel, oh, I regret, you know, doing that. The supermarkets, it's not hard to get into the supermarkets. It's pricey to get into the supermarkets. I do agree with you on one thing, that they are very a mafioso, but I'm lucky with the supermarkets that I have, you know, partnered with. For us, I should say, the challenge has been moving the product. I think retail has really suffered. The online presence for the retail establishments is not as built up. You know, people here are more used to just going to the supermarket and buying, you know, their groceries. The online thing is still, it's still not second nature, if you know what I mean. So our sales have really hurt. They've been hurting in the supermarket. And without COVID, it's very pricey to keep the product going, to keep Elysian going in, you know, marketing fees and trying to just move the product in and of itself. Alhamdulillah, it was moving much more in a lot of the supermarket chains. But now, because you see, especially in this part of the world, there is a new imported water coming in on almost a daily basis, you know? Some of them I'm very familiar with. Some of them I've never even heard of in my life. But the competition, I mean, you go there, I go there, and I'm like, oh my God, this is overwhelming. Because, you know, you've got literally like 30, 40 different brands. How do you stand out from those brands. That all goes to, you know, that's the challenge that we have more or less in from our marketing side, not really from, you know, a business side, if you know what I mean.
Just the business side of things. But I'm curious about one thing, which is, what are some of your negotiating tips when you're negotiating with distributors or, you know, stockists who want to stock your water? Like, I'm sure that you've had to, like, you know, go on, get on the table and just really, really negotiate down to the filth. You know, what are some of your tips on negotiating?
You know, and it's funny you asked me that, because like a year ago, I would have been like, what? You know, I'm not a negotiator, but I had to become a salesperson. And I've accepted that finally, because, you know, it takes years to hone that. People are sales experts and experienced, and they've done it and they've sold a plethora of products. And here I've never done it in my life. But the thing is I believe in my product, and they, honesty and truth goes a long way. And, you know, when I just sit there and I tell them about, you know, the product and what it's about, a lot of times they don't want to, you know, that doesn't really even make a difference to them. They're like, okay, yeah, whatever. We want to know the price. So I've really had to work on, you know, getting our price really competitive. And that's, I think, been the most challenging part, because we're in this really competitive, as you said, low margin industry where you have to sell volumes. And that requires like an army of teams to go out and just, you know, approach the businesses and approach the, I would say, the HoReCa sector, the hotel, restaurant, cafe sector, because that's really where our focus has been right now with our sales. Is targeting the HoReCa sector, and not even now in Bahrain, mostly in Riyadh and Sharjah, Khobar actually, to be exact, not Dammam, because I've had to be very, you know, businesses are different and I've had to adapt. So Riyadh, I'm, you know, looking at really focusing on right now, and alhamdulillah, we're making some leeway. I'm, you know, our plan is to expand, you know, in a faster way. But then you're kind of having to come out and knock out the competition, or the competition comes and knocks us out. So it's really dog eat dog.
I read this book called Blue Ocean Strategy. I don't know if you read it. It just talks about, like, you know, you're clearly in a red ocean where it's like, you know, I don't want to say similar products, because I know that Elysian is, I've tried it, I love it. I love your sparkling water. It's just good water. I love the branding. I love the name. I love the story behind it. But also, you know, you are, like you said, in a space where it's very similar, even though I know Elysian has different bottling design, which I really appreciate. But if, you know, if you don't kind of focus on some of these details, it can get lost within the sea of other water brands. And it's definitely tough, because it's also, the pricing structure is quite similar. You know, there are some expensive waters, and we know, we can point them out. And then, you know, there are the branded waters, there are the Starbucks of the yeah, water industry. And then there's some on the low side that are more local, possibly you don't know what's in them. It's a bit confusing. So it is very tough, I can imagine, sometimes being where you are. But I do really appreciate your attitude, your approach, your self-assurance. I think that's what gets people to trust you and want to work with you and want to stock the brand and want to offer Elysian to their customers. Can you tell us what is next for Elysian? I know with COVID, it's weird, it's strange. You know, companies that have, you know, the companies have dropped to zero revenue overnight. It's really a struggle. Companies that were stable are, you know, we're going on our, I don't know, sixth, seventh, eighth month now. A lot of companies are suffering. Do you have any kind of future milestones or some plans that you've put together? Or are you kind of waiting some things out to see how, you know, how the market changes? Or are you taking a bit of a break? So what's next for Elysian and yourself?
Yeah, we're never taking a break, because we want to see Elysian all over the GCC. And like I said, we're just looking for the sort of now searching for the opportunities where we can go in. And one of them is Riyadh, thankfully. And the other is the western side of Saudi Arabia, which is Jeddah. Those are two major cities that we are going to hit. And inshallah, in the next phase after that, we're looking at Kuwait and UAE. So, you know, I just want to, I started it in Bahrain, as you know, and it did well, and you know, it lived out what we needed to until COVID hit. And, you know, now there's a challenge, right? You know, especially with Saudis. Now we all know Saudis are not able to go to Bahrain, and that also has hurt the economy of Bahrain. So I'm never going to stop focusing on that, because that's really where I started. That's my hub. But as phases, you know, move along, we're looking to expand in other parts of Saudi, then the GCC. And it only makes sense for me because the US is my other home, and I have people there that want it. So I, you know, that's going to be the phase after that. But that I have to build, you know, myself internally, with my team, with the structure of, you know, having, you know, not people going in and out, this rapid turnover rate, it's ridiculous. So I've got to get that situated first. And I'm very positive about that. I feel, just be patient. It's the process. God will send you good people. You know, people, when I say good, I mean good for Elysian and good for Scan, and that will look at this as, you know, an opportunity of growth. So, and for myself, listen, I'm, you know, every day is a day where I wake up, I'm like, I'm grateful. You and I have had this conversation, obviously, you know, alhamdulillah, thank you for the, you know, the food in my belly, the water in my, you know, in my hand, the roof over my head, my parents, my family. Gratitude brings abundance. So, you know, I remind myself of that. And alhamdulillah, it's become second nature, you know. And every day I try to make something that I did yesterday better, or, you know, build upon, you know, try to take away a bad habit, or a not so conducive habit, I should say. So that's, yeah, it's an ongoing thing.
Shima, thank you so much. I really wanted to have you on this podcast because I do really believe in your brand. I am personally a huge fan of Elysian, and nothing would make me happier than to see other people buying it, you know, enjoying it, sharing the feedback with you as well. So I hope that people understand, you know, what you're going through to put this out there. I think a lot of these brands have a lot of corporate firms, like you said. There's like usually a holding company, and they do a lot of things, and then they have like this water brand. But with you, it is a startup. I think it's very much a family business. It has this energy of a family business. So I do hope that people see that and they connect with the brand when they see it in the store and pick it up, and also share what they think with us as well. They try the sparkling and the still. So thank you so much. And I hope that you continue to paint. I know that you paint for fun and it looks beautiful. I hope you're able to do that as well. So good luck, and I hope we get to see each other again really soon.
Me too. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this week. Thank you for listening to an episode of the Woman Power Podcast. And thank you for downloading and streaming our podcast every week. If you love what you've heard, tag us on Instagram and follow the Woman Power Podcast and Woman Power Summit account for more information on our next episode. Please leave a rating review wherever you get your podcast. It really helps other women discover the show. That's it from me. See you next week. Once again, I want to thank our friends at Zenon Cycling for sponsoring this episode of the Woman Power Podcast. Follow them on Instagram and support what they do. Check out